Hey everyone, welcome back to this very exciting weekend of Script Apart specials. My name's Al Horner, and if you're joining us for the first time, this is typically a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows, in which amazing filmmakers break down their first drafts of beloved screenplays. Not this weekend, though. This weekend, we're running an event called the Storyteller Sessions. 3 days of career-spanning conversations with seriously game-changing storytellers about their relationships with the page. It's all in aid of a fantastic charity called the Entertainment Community Fund, so if you enjoy this episode or any of the other episodes we're running this weekend, please do consider hitting that link in today's show notes and donating to that great cause. On today's episode, a conversation about writing with one of my heroes, Lily Wachowski. Or at least, that was the plan. We were meant to speak about writing. The plan was to talk about her creative practice, about the queer-coded stories of collective resistance and love in the face of dystopia that she's told across a glittering three-decade career. One of those stories in particular, the Matrix trilogy, co-written and directed with her sister, Lana Wachowski, was very much the looking glass through which I stepped into a new way of seeing both cinema and the world when I was just 11 years old. Life was never the same for me after I saw that film for the first time, so you can imagine how astonishingly excited I was to speak with Lily about that trilogy, the incredible films and TV shows of hers and Lana's that followed, and the writing tricks and tips that allowed those stories to be told. But that's not what went down. Yes, there is plenty in this conversation about writing. We talk about why Lily prioritizes writing stories not about individualist heroes, but about communities coming together to defy power. We talk about why writing film and TV is right now a release valve for her, helping her channel what she calls her trans rage at a system that tramples over marginalized groups. You'll also hear her discuss why she believes great stories can offer an escape path for audiences out of that system, and how she approaches finding the visual devices that so cleanly communicate the complex ideas at the center of her and Lana's films. But that's not all that we talked about. Across a massively moving 2 hours, the filmmaker told me all about how, when she looks back on her and Lana's early movies now, she sees clearly the scratchings on the wall as they were clawing their way out of the closet, as she puts it. She speaks so beautifully and candidly about her experience transitioning, about how she found her way back to herself after a period of burnout that also encompassed the dissolution of a relationship, and the heartache of watching her mother suffer from dementia. We get into the impossible bar that the Matrix set for her and Lana, and Lily's thoughts on AI in 2023, as someone who co-created one of our culture's defining works about that technology. We also talk about the joy of her experience on Work in Progress, a smaller scale departure from the sci-fi with which Lily made her name, and we conclude by discussing why the next chapter of her career is going to be all about, as Lily puts it, throwing my trans body against the monoculture that Hollywood is gravitating towards. It was a huge privilege to share this conversation with Lily, who I can't thank enough for being so open and so insightful. Again, this conversation is in aid of the Entertainment Community Fund, who do extraordinary work lifting up storytellers of all descriptions, and have been such a vital support for entertainment industry workers affected by this summer's strikes. If you enjoyed this episode, it really would mean the world to us if you'd consider clicking the link in the show notes and donating any amount you can spare to that great cause. Okay, with that all out the way, let's jump in. This is the one and only Lily Wachowski's Script Apart Storyteller Session in aid of the Entertainment Community Fund. Thank you so much for tuning in. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demek. Hey Lily, such an honor to have you with us. How's it going today?
It's okay, Al. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I've been really looking forward to this because, well, I may as well put my cards on the table right now. Your work has profoundly impacted my life, Lily. It struck me while I was prepping for this conversation that so much of who I am in terms of my understanding of art, politics, capitalism, queerness and beyond, it's all kind of traceable back to growing up with your movies. Like, The Matrix really was my gateway to so many things. I'm sure you and Lana hear that all the time. So I'll begin things with this question, Lily. Does it get any less surreal as the years go on, hearing that kind of response to your work, hearing about the enormity of your influence on people's lives, hearing how, in many cases like my own, your films may have lent someone a certain kind of revolutionary mindset that they otherwise might not have found?
First of all, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on the show. I think that the way that I react to those kinds of things has changed quite a bit over the course of my life. Like, particularly when I think about like the ways that the closet affected me as a human being, how it affected me affected me in terms of like the way that I engaged with the world, the way that the fear that of exposure like constantly kicked in my flight instinct. And so when people would come up to me and tell me, you know, how much they love my films and how they were personally affected by them, there was a part of me that understood that in those films, there was this sort of Rosetta Stone of what I was going through. And certainly I can probably say the same thing about Lana. Like, you can see in them the what we're how we're like mapping our way out of the closet. And so when somebody would come to me and tell me how much they love the films, there was a reticence to engage with folks. And now that I can look back and go, oh, wow, there was a lot of stuff where we're trying to work out. That, and the fact that we arrived where we both have gotten to in our lives as these, you know, out trans women, how those films act as this like roadmap in a way. And like how I can suddenly see myself in some of the folks, like particularly trans folks who come up to me and tell me like how affected they were by our films. And that part of it is really, I feel so much gratitude that I've been able to, you could see the scratchings on the wall as we were mapping our way out of the closet. So that part's super cool.
Wow, the scratchings on the wall as we were mapping our way out of the closet. That's really powerful, Lily. I can only imagine how strange and how interesting it must be revisiting those films as the person you are today, seeing all the ways in which your subconscious was leaving clues about the people that you and Lana were to become. Like with The Matrix, for example, you've described previously how you didn't mean to add to that movie a certain kind of trans allegory. You thought you were simply making a great action movie at the time. But when you reflect back on those films today, there it is simmering beneath the surface. That must be so interesting to kind of reckon with.
I got this invitation to come to the Lambda Literary Awards. And it was like this, there was a real struggle to accept the invitation, because the invitation was predicated on the idea that I would get this award as like, you know, a visionary award. And I was like, visionary, I don't know. You know, this person who had been in the closet for so long, you know, like 40 something years to get out. And I was like, that's not much of a visionary. And so I eventually said yes, because it's like my presence there was like a support to the organization and a support to, you know, queer literature. And so I was like, I was down for that. But a lot of what I was talking about in my acceptance speech was like, why am I getting this award? Why, you know, I look back and I describe the idea of looking back on our films. And like for me, there's like a there is a level of what I see as the films are in a way this note passed under a door. And so I have a lot of there's like a difference for me. Like I don't like Lana is different because Lana like was out a lot earlier than I was, and she got to experience like making this art as an out trans woman. And like I didn't have that until after Sense8. I came out on the first season of Sense8, and so for me, there's like there's a slight disconnect between, you know, what's happened and like what is like coming and like with work in progress. So it's like I have it's almost like it's not exactly me that is in that stuff, and it is, but it isn't. And so I like it, the films that we made acted were like I said, they were a map. They were this sort of magic trick of like creating a rope out of thin air and then pulling yourself along.
That's a really beautiful way of putting it. So Lily, we're talking not long after this summer of industrial action by writers who you've been out supporting. I saw a really great clip of you on the picket line in Chicago recently, talking about the correlation between what the WGA were taking a stand against with that strike and this kind of wider societal problem around, as you put it, the flow of wealth in the world right now. I was wondering if you could expand upon that for our listeners, because it's such an interesting phrase. It seems so apt. There's a sense among writers that we're kind of the canaries in the coal mine right now, in that what we've been fighting for is, it's a battle that's coming to everyone outside the upper class, outside the elite, just in terms of having like your workers' rights squeezed, having automation kind of creep in and start to erode some of your protections as a worker, all that kind of thing. Some of what you were saying in that clip seemed to speak to that.
Okay. Well, this is a huge topic, which could be its own show. The one thing that I would object to in that question is that it's a fight that's coming for us all soon. It's like the fight is here. You know, we're in the fight. We've been in the fight. And I think like people are, I think we've been so, we've been inured to this idea of the rugged individual or the nuclear family, that we've like found these ways how we compartmentalize ourselves into these smaller and ever smaller and smaller groups, like down to the individual, right? And so that kind of constant message, that sort of propaganda has created this divide amongst all of humanity, we are on a ball floating in space, you know? So like when I think about like what's happening with climate change, you know, climate change isn't the thing, it's climate disaster. Climate disaster is here. And that's what we need to be thinking about when we think about like the 1% and like, you know, who owns this small portion of society, who owns the biggest pile of wealth. It's not just that. It's like, what else do they own? It's not just the money. It's like, what do they actually own? And see how much of what they own affects our lives, you know, not just like what's happening in film and television with these vertically integrated monstrosities, but it's like all of communication, all of media, the news, where we get our food, our politics, the Supreme Court is like in the United States is, they're just funneling money into these people who are supposed to be, these judges who are supposed to be completely impartial. And I mean, when you the when you see like the way resistance is manifesting itself in around the world, you can see it. It's like not just the writers, it's not just the actors. You see it in like the teachers' unions, all that were taking place over like quite a few years ago here in this country. You see it in like the auto workers, in the rail workers, in I wrote a bunch of notes. Oh, like Amazon and Starbucks, like that all of these like all of this solidarity is like it was a necessary thing like 20 years ago when when you started to have all these antitrust laws breaking down and like the allowing for all these mergers to take place, 40 years ago. And so I think like the writer strike is like is a microcosm of what's going on all over the world. And I had wished that that the Directors Guild had had a little bit of vision to like see their place in the fight, and they didn't, unfortunately. But they're going to reap the rewards of, the struggle that and solidarity, the incredible solidarity that the writers had, and IATSE who joined them, and the Teamsters who joined them, and then the actors joined them. And you can see it like bubbling out into like video games and the background artists and all of these other things that and visual effects artists. It's just like we're all singing to each other in this like amazing chorus, and we just have to keep our voices as strong as we can for as long as we can.
Absolutely. Well, you're of course someone who's written inspiring stories about acts of collective resistance. That's a running theme in your work. So, no surprise to hear that you were moved by the solidarity you saw out there, Lily. You're also a writer who has quite famously written about the distinction between man and machine and the threat that AI might pose to humanity. AI was, of course, a big part of the reason for that strike action. Hollywood studios have been exploring replacing writers with programs like ChatGPT. So I did want to take just a minute to ask, as somewhat of an expert on this subject matter, what do you make of the kind of slow creep of AI into storytelling, Lily? How flawed do you think the studio's assumption is that algorithms can replace writers who have lived experience and lived human emotion to pour into their stories?
I mean, I think I think it's a real threat. It's a real thing. And I mean, I'm a person who loves tools. We were, in between, from Matrix One to the two sequels, we were constantly trying to push technology to do something new, something that hadn't been seen before. and like a there were we didn't just it didn't come out of a vacuum or anything like that, but there was like a few visual effects artists who were working on this idea of like untethering the camera from reality. And so I like I said, I love a good tool, and they are so meaningful in the way that filmmakers can express themselves. So when I think about like ChatGPT or OpenAI and what they mean for the industry, it's like they're not tools exactly to help filmmakers tell stories. In my point of view, they're tools for the industry to hoard wealth. They are wealth-making tools. They are tools to cut artists out of the process. And I know that it's not like the technology, in the same way that you have bullet time to the visual effects of today with the way that the camera has been untethered, that like took time to get to where visual effects are today. And so the idea that somebody can just like hit a button and pop out a script at this point that's not really realistic, but in 5 years, maybe. And I think like the way that tool would be used would be incremental, and it would be an incremental process to cut the writers out of the equation. In this, like, there's a correlation between like how a director directs a commercial and how a director like shoots a movie. And so like the difference is like in a commercial, you have this like board, like the ad executives, they give you the storyboards. They help you, they point the camera. We want this shot. This is what it should look like. And so I can see a studio just like going, oh yeah, we took, you know, we punched in some Cameron, we punched in some Cronenberg, and we threw in a little, you know, Robert Rodriguez, and like, here you go, and like, make this. And, you know, they'll give you the storyboards, or they'll give you a script, and you, the writer, will have to do a polish on it. Here, fix this up. And so you don't get like screenplay by Jane Schmo. You get screenplay by, you know, Warner Scripts. And so like that's the real fear, I think, in the next 5 years, you'll start getting that. And like, you can already see it the way the bottom line economics of filmmaking has become this idol, you know, that it's like this informs every decision, like what the bottom line of, you know, how this film is being made, whether this film is being made. It's like, yeah.
I suppose where that gets scary in terms of film as an art form is, you know, in every single one of my favorite films, in every single one of my favorite TV shows, the writer has left a little piece of themselves on the page. Like, they might not have done so intentionally, but it's there, and it's rooting the story in an experience that they've lived and I might live to, an emotion that they felt and I might feel to. We kind of risk losing that, don't we, by letting AI generate stories. I mean, well, you were just talking a moment ago about how you and Lana were leaving pieces of yourselves in your films back then that you didn't even realize you were leaving, that helped give them their humanity and their emotion.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, I mean, you know, our stories are like a culmination of so many things. They're like a culmination of, you know, all of the people in our lives, all of the art we've consumed, all of the, and then all of the queerness and all of the transness and all of the, like our experience of being closeted for so long. And like, yeah, for sure. Most definitely.
Well, speaking of that culmination, I'd love to kind of go back a little bit and talk about your life, Lily, and hear a little bit about like where your relationship with storytelling began, and sort of where some of the seeds for the themes in your work, where they kind of took root and then to eventually blossom years later. So I'm aware that you kind of grew up in Beverly, and I understand that you and Lana would have these epic movie marathons, like orchestrated by your parents who loved cinema. I'm curious, like, was there a particular film from that time that you remember sparking in you that deep need to be a storyteller?
Yeah, we called them, mom and dad called them movie orgies. And so I was so young, I was like, I don't know what an orgy is, but I love it. Yeah, I don't think there's like one film, you know, it was because we saw so much and such like variety. I think there's like an alchemy to it, that there's a chain reaction that starts to happen when you see so much and you see like the variety of what film can be. So like, you know, when we were growing up, we saw everything, but it was like, you know, there were so many Westerns on that we would watch on like Fraser Thomas, Sunday morning classic, you know, this 3 o'clock, this guy would come on one of the channels here in Chicago, and they'd have like, you know, Robin Hood and all these Westerns and swashbucklers and the Vikings. And we were also watching some Western serials like the Cisco Kid. And then you'd sort of expand your worldview, and it would include like, you know, different genres, like, you know, the horror, like The Blob and King Kong and The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And then you put all those kinds of films, and then you start plopping in these, like, in the movie orgies, we'd go out and see films like Harold and Maude and The King of Hearts and Where's Papa? I remember seeing that, and just like these like very adult films, or like with a political, they had more of a political point of view, and they opened our brains up to what film could be, that it just like was this it was just this melting pot of stuff. And like Excalibur, I saw that when I was super young, and my mom, I was like, oh my God. And my mom would be like holding her hand over my head. It was like, we were a caricature of a family in a way, but just blown away by it.
Yeah. It sounds like you had exposure to other creative disciplines. Like I know that you and Lana, you know, you'd record audio plays on cassette tape, inspired by the Shadow comic books and radio programs. You wrote and drew comics. There was even High Adventure, which was a 300-page game that you wrote with friends, which sounds really interesting. But ultimately, it was filmmaking that you decided upon as your medium, and that was what you zeroed in on as the main vehicle for your storytelling. Why was that? What was special about film that transcended the other mediums you were kind of dabbling in?
I think it has to do with like how established filmmaking was, you know, at that point. You know, it's like 100-year-old medium. I mean, I guess like comics were and are as old in a way, but at the time, I think comics were, have they even ever really escaped the superhero genre? I'm not sure if that's true, but you know, in the 80s, you could see these artists like independent comics that would like rail against the superhero genre, you know, comics by like Dan Close and Harvey Picar and like Julie Doucette. You know, there's some others that I'm blanking on. It wasn't like when you compared that to what film could be and like the types of films that could be, you know, like, and I started writing down all these names like David Lynch and Spike Lee and Jane Campion and Ernst Lubitsch and Sergio Leone and John Borman and John Waters. Like, you know, you have this like complete, you know, amazing, amazing variety. It's like I think like that kind of sandbox was like very appealing to us. It's like we would have been happy doing anything as a writer or an artist, like happy to do games. But you know, I think games like particularly are going through a renaissance right now because there's so much variety, and there's something about the communal experience of a game that I sort of went off the rails there. Sorry.
No, it was beautiful. But yeah, so obviously your parents were quite important in exposing you to all this great cinema. It sounds like they weren't the only ones who were quite pivotal in shaping both the stories that you were beginning to tell and some of the beautiful worldviews within them. Like I know, for example, your grandmother, Grams, is someone who you've described leaving an indelible mark. Her atoms can be felt in every one of my and my sister's films. Can you talk me through some of these characters in your life at this time who helped imbue you with the ideals that you'd ultimately carry into your movies, Lily?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my mom and dad, they're certainly, and mom and dad and my two sisters, they're my two other sisters, Julie and Laura. They're like as much or more in the work that we do. They are, you know, so important to my own becoming. You know, it's like I learned how to be a woman from these two women, these my two sisters and my mom and my grandma and my aunts. My aunt Sandy, who taught me like the joy of games and the joy of play. She we would spend our summers out there, and so we would always in Indiana, my mom and dad, we didn't go to camp because like mom and dad were too cheap to put a there's four kids. I mean, I get it. So they would like dump us in Indiana with Sandy and Grams, and we'd play in the lake, we'd go home and we'd eat pizza and we'd, you know, play, or else I would go learn how to golf with my Aunt Sandy, or we'd bowl, you know. Good Polish families, we'd all bowl. And my gramps would like say, whoever gets the next strike gets a $5. And so you'd like get a strike and you'd go run over there and get your payout. And then I had, you know, all of these strong women were in my life. I have an aunt Peggy, who is was a nurse with my mom, and my world opened up so much because of her, because she was in San Francisco during the height of the AIDS crisis, and all of her friends were dying, and so like that part of the world opened up in this like horrible way, but like exponential way. It began like you can see like the things in your life that you how your world gets bigger and bigger. And I started to understand about my own queerness, and I had a sense of like my connectivity to queerness in this really profound and earth-shattering way. Lots of good people.
Yeah. And great bowlers too, by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
I'm curious as well, like when I alluded to earlier, like that message of collective power that runs through your work, you know, your movies and shows so often arrive at this idea that anything is surmountable with each other. Like it's connectivity, it's collaboration, and it's participation that save the day so often in your stories, rather than a reliance on one hero and their bravery, usually his bravery. Where, when you look back on that period of your life, like where do you think it was that you learned the importance of that, so much so that it did become one of the running themes of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a hodgepodge of stuff. Me and my sisters were born in the 60s. And so this is like, historically, it's a time where had my mom and dad not been having kids, they probably would have been more involved with organizing and the civil rights movement. And, you know, mom and dad were, they met in New Orleans, and they were hyper aware of like the civil rights movement at the time and like segregation, and it's like the Deep South. So you're talking about like being in like right at the forefront of all of that. And so they moved to Chicago, and like Chicago was, you know, the Democratic Convention and the riots there. And, you know, there was so much going on. And I think that like that spirit of resistance and that spirit of human rights was something that we just sort of was burned into our DNA. And so, you know, you grow up and I'm a young person, and you're under the Reagan administration and Margaret Thatcher, and you're seeing like this this rightward shift in the way that the country is organizing itself. And you know, we're in Chicago, and Chicago, for as much as I love it, I love this city so much. It's like to really love Chicago is to like understand like what Chicago is and like how impossibly segregated it is. And so, you know, we would we lived on in this like hyper affluent white neighborhood where we didn't fit in so well. And we would drive across the south side of Chicago to go to high school downtown in this like extremely like integrated school. And that kind of like daily passage from like this bubble of whiteness through like, you know, the south side of Chicago to this ideal of what are a cross section of the population of Chicago. And you begin to understand like how there's something wrong with that picture. And so you take all of that stuff and you combine it with the idea that I'm this closeted trans person. It's like the yearning for collectivity, the yearning for something else, that like yearning for community for me was like that was the hope for myself. I was writing my own potential future, or trying to imagine a way to get there.
That's really beautiful. It's something you just said about the rightward shift of that time. We are in a rightward shift right now. We have shifted rightwards. And it's interesting, like right now, I'd say as a culture, we're in a moment in terms of cinema of much more in the way of stories of individual heroes rather than collective resistors. Just as an aside, do you think we need more stories about collective resistance right now, because, you know, the fight to stop climate change, the fight against those who want to roll back queer rights, the fight against those who want to limit access to abortion, all of these battles won't be won by one person. They'll be won by collective struggle. So do you think right now, as we sit in the midst of this slide towards fascism, slide towards the right, do you feel like we need fewer of those stories that are like propping up and lionizing one hero, and more stories like revolutions, I suppose, that does kind of say it's together that we'll beat this?
You know, absolutely. I think art is like hugely influential when it comes to participating in that kind of dialogue with the world. It can often be a mirror, and like specifically science fiction does that so well. It's a hard question, because it's just like, there's so much art that has already been made about collectivity and connectivity. And you can see that, like a show like Work in Progress gets pulled off of the streaming service. And it's just like, there needs to be, to me, there needs to be a fight to, we need to include in our fight for the way that this industry, the reshaping of this industry, we need to be able to reclaim our art. We need to be able to say, because like, from my opinion, the way I look at it, filmmaking, like when you cannot make film nowadays without public participation. So many films are government subsidized. The tax breaks that these films are getting. So in a way, that's ours. That's our art. And so we should be able to have access to it. And so we need to include a fight for some sort of nationalized or global data bank, so that we can preserve all of our stories. It's like, I love that quote, you can't be what you cannot see. And it's like, for me, a queer person, a trans person, it's like those kinds of bits of art and ephemera, I need to be able to get at that kind of stuff, so that I can imagine the world that that I want to live in, you know? And so, yeah, I know I kind of like, I took a little tour of a question there, but I guess what I was getting at was that they're not making those kinds of films. It's like, I think that, because it is such a capitalist driven model right now, the types of films that you're talking about that we need are going to be fewer and fewer between. But there's still like, you can still find like these amazing like spikes of radical worldviews and stuff like, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. That movie just blew me away. I was just like, and the way that film wrapped up, it was such a joy that they're like, they set out to do this thing and then they did it. And it wasn't like, there wasn't a betrayer, that the cops didn't like win or like throw a wrench in the equation. They were like, oh no, we have this one person who maybe is, you're not sure if they're a weak link, and then they aren't. And then they blow up the pipeline because they're imagining a world that they want to see. We have to win in the war against climate disaster. We have to. And so that's the ending of the film. or a film like, the show Station 11, like dealing with pandemic. Like that show just blew me away and was so beautiful the way that it ended. And these two people just took these different paths. Both of those filmmakers I reached out to on Twitter, and it was like I'm obsessively trying to remind myself the themes of my own films, and that connectivity is the thing that's going to save us. And so just like sending those filmmakers a ping and telling them how much their work affected me was that was like the least I could do. And it's like, the end.
That's so true. And I want to come back to a phrase you used there about, you cannot be what you cannot see. I think that's so true. It has obviously a multitude of applications, that phrase. And one of them, my own personal application of that phrase, I suppose, is I feel better equipped to resist empire in 2023 because I have a blueprint from it, from some of the films that I watched as a kid, including The Matrix, including V for Vendetta. There's a line in Cloud Atlas that I think speaks to the same sentiment. I mean, all credit to David Mitchell here, I suppose, but you brought this line to the screen so beautifully. All boundaries are conventions. One may transcend any convention if only one can first conceive of doing so. I think that's such a special line, and it makes me think about the ways in which film can be like an arena for helping people conceive of new ideas and futures that don't yet exist. Like, as I kind of mentioned, like each and every one of your films, I think, has helped me conceive of ways to resist empire and to ways to live like a different, kinder life to the one that I feel like the world often wants me to live. And I don't know that I necessarily would have been able to envision that without seeing it on screen first. Is that part of what drives you, Lily, in your storytelling? Do you see that as a responsibility? Do you want to kind of give people a way of conceiving things that otherwise they may not be able to?
I don't know if it is something that is like such a conscious choice that I'm making so much as a mental note reminder stuck on the refrigerator in my brain. It's like when I think back at like our filmography, and I like the first shot of our filmography is a closet, and you fast forward to like, ideas of self-determination in Matrix, and or not self-determination, but self-actualization. And, and even to that line in Cloud Atlas, and then all the way to Know Me. All of those things, I'm writing, or I'm writing with Lana, and like, as Lana's partner, as a way for me to transcend like the boundaries that I've been given, the boundaries of gender, the boundaries, of transness. And so it's like, I'm writing it as much for you as I am for me. And it's like I have to constantly remind myself of what my films are about. And they give me, as much reason and impetus to engage with folks as anybody else, I guess. So, yes. Did I answer it?
You did. You did beautifully. You mentioned writing. We haven't really got into the nuts and bolts of what it actually looks like when you're writing, Lily. Talk me through some of your kind of rituals and creative habits. Like when you sit down to write, is there a process that you swear by, and has that process been set in stone ever since you got into this business, or has it evolved?
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, like, I guess the first thing I'd say is, like, I've always, like, written with a partner, and like Lana is, she is a just a whirling dervish of a writer, and so, like, I'm an extremely constipated writer. You know, it's like there's a reason why it took me 40 something years to get out of the closet. I'm a slow burner. And so, because Lana has so much energy, like, I often was a just like support and like editorial. And but there are some parts of that practice that, like, always stuck with me for whatever reason. And it's like one of the main things I'd say that I do that we've always done and I maintain is, like, this idea of, like, scene cards, like, as a tool. I think that there is something for me, there is a I had a good phrase here. I wrote it down. What was it? Oh, it's there is a visual congruency to the form of film.
Wow.
These are literally little tiny rectangles. And it's like a film is a mosaic of teeny tiny frames. And so, like, I can tell there's, like, a visual equivalency between the two things. It's like when I use scene cards, they take on a collage aspect. There's a collageness to it. It's like when you look around my office, you can see, like, it's like the collage is the mosaic is a form that I am fascinated by, and because it's like microcosm and macrocosm. There's like a thing that's like small that you can like zoom in on, and then there's a thing that's big that you can zoom out on. And like that part of it, I think, is like that feels really good and satisfying to me when I'm like, so there's like this part in, like, you know, like I keep notebooks and I write. Sometimes I write longhand. Sometimes I write on the computer, less so on the computer. It's just like the one sort of constant is like how slow I am. it's hideous. And then if I'm writing in a group, you know, that can go a little faster. It's like the way that I would write with Lana was like completely different with the way that I wrote with, you know, progressively bigger writers' rooms from the first season of Work in Progress to the second season. You know, that was three people, me, Abby, and Tim Mason. And then the second season of Work in Progress was like, it was like eight people. And so, yeah, I mean, but always I was like, we're going to do this. And we would all, like, with the big group, it was like we were all staring at this giant spread of cards over the course of the entire season. And so, yes.
And during that process, like, how would you define the kind of breakdown between what you're conscious of wanting to express in the work versus what you're just going to let, just getting down the story on the page that you want to tell and trusting that there's going to be meaning in there, that there's going to be depth to it, that there are subtle expressions that maybe you haven't consciously reckoned with that are going to insert themselves into the work?
Right. I mean, like, as I get older, I'm more, like, the question of why comes up why make this? What is the reason I want to make this? Why do I want to tell this story? What is the thing about this story that makes it important to me? I think like those two things over the course of my life as a filmmaker have flipped, where it was like, I think before it was always like, I want to make something cool and I'm going to put all this like secret stuff in it. And now it's like, I'm like, yeah, I want to make something f fun or funny or cool, but like, what do I want to say? What is this about? Like that is like more, there's more emphasis that is put on that in my writing process. And so, you know, when I think about like what am I writing now? I'm writing about trans rage. You know, that's what I want to write about. That's what like gives me fuel when I wake up and I look at the state of the world for all of my trans siblings. I'm just like, I have to like write something that speaks to this. It's like Work in Progress was about that, was about more about the idea of you can't be what you cannot see, like this amazing, hilarious, fat queer dyke that Abby is. The fact that there has never been a character portrayed like that was the reason to make it. I was like, I have to make this thing for my friend who I've never seen anything like her on my screen before. And like in that, it became like whenever I think about like subversion and subverting narrative, like anytime I think about putting queer characters in genre, putting trans characters in genre, even like black and brown characters in genre, all of those to me are acts of revolution because they subvert the form in ways that we as an audience haven't seen before. And so like that is like always at the forefront of my whys.
And do you get catharsis from that? Like when you write about trans rage, does that help you like exist in the world where you have plenty of reasons to be rageful about the treatment of trans people?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge self. Huge. I'm working on this piece and it's like I had just read I had, the two things happen. I saw this art show and I can't the guy's name has gone out of my head. I saw this art show and at the Whitney when I got to go to New York which is always awesome. And there was this piece where it was an early version of like these deep fakes. And the deep fake was of like George Bush, W. Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld, and Dick Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice, all in these like orange jumpsuits, crying and apologizing for their participation in the Iraq War, the invasion of Iraq. And so I recently seen that, and I recently read this book. His name is also going on. I think his name is Percival Everett, I think his name is, and he wrote this book called The Trees. And The Trees is about the ghost of Emmett Till coming back and exacting revenge. And it's like part ghost story, part American Gothic, part like black detective novel. And but the writer is writing exactly what he needs to see. in a world where he's not going to get the type of justice that that is deserved. And so he's exacting the justice as an artist. And so those the catharsis of that, the catharsis of reading that, and there's like the, you know, the book is like really wonderful. It's funny as shit, and it's you're crying and you're laughing, and like that is the kind of, when I think about like this speaking to trans rage, it's like I need to see not just a level of justice. I need to see like trans love and trans joy and trans happiness and trans comedy. It's just like all of these things we don't get in the world. And so, yeah, it's so important. It's so, it's like catharsis, but it's like a super salve of catharsis. Like this healing takes place when I'm writing it, I can feel it. It's like, I giggle and I get so much joy out of like these characters and, you know, yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, I suppose that's why shows like Work in Progress are so important in helping widen the range of LGBTQ plus stories that that get to be told on screen. Lily, one thing I should ask about is what your first drafts tend to look like, because, well, Script Apart is typically a show about the first drafts of great movies and great TV shows. I'd love to know whether your first passes at stories tend to resemble the finished film, and whether it's, you know, typically just a case of tightening elements up, or whether the complexity and the ambition of these tales tends to mean kind of drastically different first drafts, in which there are wildly different endings, massively different plot points, different iterations of characters, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, it takes a lot to like turn my ship. It takes a lot of energy. You know, the ship is like, it's going along at its pace. Is it going along? I mean, you have to check the horizon to see if it's moving sometimes. And so I don't think that I get to a, you know, I don't like wildly run through a draft to a point where I get to the last page and then I step back and I go, no, we should have been going in that direction. You know, it's like, there will be, I think when you finish a draft and, I mean, I feel like I go so slow that I'm always like seeing where I've made wrong turns or veered off in a direction that I'm always able to write the ship and then like go back and fix stuff in the in earlier pages. And so I usually get to the end and I step back and it's like it just needs some massaging. I mean, it's very similar to the way we would edit our films. Like the very first passes of our films, they're like super rough, although they're not as rough as they used to be, because you spend so much time in an editing room that it becomes a little simpler, and a little, you're able to see how the pieces like fit together. You do puzzles enough that you get good at putting all those pieces in place. And so I think that's true of like writing as well. It's like, and you know, this is all like contextually, you have to understand that like writing by myself is a lot different than when I was writing with Lana, or when I was writing with like Abby, or when I was writing with Abby and a giant group. Yeah, they're all of them are different processes, but like I think that ultimately you, so long as you're holding that idea of what is this, what is it about, if you're holding that idea in your head, you're going to like come out of the other end with a form that is that there is some structural integrity to what that overarching thematic is.
And how about the kind of visual devices that you often use to explain the heady concepts of your stories, Lily? Where in the writing process do you tend to find those? Because it's something I'm really in awe of, how often you and Lana are able to take like a very mind-bending intellectual idea and then find a visual way of communicating it that is so simple anyone can wrap their heads around it. Like a great example, I suppose, is the spoon in The Matrix. 11 years old, I was way too young, obviously, to understand simulation theory, but that visual device, there is no spoon, that moment, it kind of made the entire concept of The Matrix make perfect sense to me, even at that young age. Is there a method to how you arrive at these visual devices that are so important in unlocking the big ideas that are contained within your stories?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it's like I think that we were always there's not really a process. It's just like I think like the when you present the question, what is this about? It like informs everything, and like you pose the question and then try to, you know, if you were like a good collaborator is going to bring in their co-collaborators, the heads of department on a film, and they're going to pose those questions to those heads of department. And so you're going to get all sorts of different forms of that question exhibiting itself in the way the not just the way the story is told, but way the film looks from your cinematographer to your production designer to your costume designer to the choices the actors are making. Like that was like one of the great things for me about being a filmmaker is you get in the sandbox with all of these different artists and you make this thing together. And so, like, the idea, I mean, you know, it starts with Bound in that closet at the beginning. Like, you know, that is like mine and Lana's subconscious, you know, I want out. That's how that shot ends. It's like it's nothing's clearer than that for these two trans women. Like, and then you like the, you know, there is no spoon. You know, that is like comes out of the idea of worlds within worlds and these reflections. We were like, we want to put reflections everywhere in this piece. And then, you know, Lana had come up with this the idea of just, you know, all the theoretical stuff Lana was really into, and like the idea of there's no spoon, and the idea of transcending physicality was that was a great way to sort of exhibit that. But I mean, like the reflection part was like, yeah, that was just like the idea of like Escher and like worlds within worlds and like, you know, entering in through the looking glass and all of that business.
Let me ask a simple question, but quite a big question, Lily. I'm always curious about the things that writers, even with your level of success, still find challenging about the process and the industry. So, Yeah. Well, what would you say is the hardest part of being a storyteller right now?
I don't know. That's a good question. I want to, I keep like finding myself in these like pockets. Like I went to the socialism conference here in Chicago, and just I'm like extremely interested in organizing and different, like plugging myself into forms of resistance and stuff like that. And one of the themes that kept popping up there, and I know it had come up in some other space that I was in, where a lot of the folks were talking about movements, and if you are not arguing amongst yourself, you're not doing it right. And I think like there is like difficulty as a storyteller to engage outside of your point of view with other points of views. But it is an absolute necessity to the process. And so there, you know, yeah, I think like that part of it, like it's hard to make something with a collective because there are so many different ways to tell a story. There are so many different points of view and different voices, and like, how do you bring all those things together? That's like the difficult part, but it's also like the whole reason why I want to do it. And yeah, that's like, you know, I said this thing about we're all on this ball floating in space. You know, it's like that idea of the we, you know, you zoom out far enough, you can see that we're not able to go anywhere else or do anything else that is going to take away that concept of, you know, we are on this ball and we have to find a way we've got to find a way to coexist, or else it's curtains. That's the struggle. That is the struggle.
But what are the moments then that make it worthwhile, that make all the challenges of trying to kind of pull this thing together collectively, like a piece of film, a piece of art? Like what are the moments that where it's worth how arduous it can be sometimes?
You know, I think that is a thing that's like changed for me over my life. It's like when you're, you know, and I think like I try to remind myself to refocus why I want to do this. And the reason is not to get to the finished the finished thing, the end. It's not the finish line. It's the making. The making is the most important thing of filmmaking. It's not what happens afterwards and who watches it and the reviews and did I do a boffo? You know, that those questions, it's just like that doesn't matter. It's like, what was the journey like? You know, it's like there's so many, like, and it's like a thing that I'm like, I constantly relearn and relearn. And it's just like, I can see that the journeys were the thing, but I didn't pay attention as much. Like that, I can look back and I can see that damn closet in the beginning of Bound and go, oh, wow, you really had some stuff going on there. And like, but now I'm like, I can like suddenly I can like look up and I can like one eyeball can like poke out and see, in Work in Progress where Abby's dead mom has come back and she gets to have a conversation with her. It's like, my mom had just like died. My mom died 5 years ago, this past Sunday, and I went into Work in Progress after having after going through that kind of loss. And in the making of that scene, in the writing, I mean, in the writing of it, I was just like, oh yeah, Abby's mom is coming back. We have to have, she's got that box and her mom shows up and it's there was like so much happening in the world at the time. And like that, the way, George Floyd calling out for his mom and, the idea that all mothers were summoned. That part of the making, I got to watch Abby summon her mom. And my mom's painting is behind Abby, the character, on set while she's doing it. So I was summoning my mom. And that was like one of the reasons to make it. And it's like I want queers to be able to see this show so that they can see themselves, but I'm not that my personal investment isn't anybody who sees something and is affected by my work, my art, like that is like gravy on top of it. Like I get a lot of joy when folks tell me they love my films and that they've helped them in their life and their journeys. But it's like to me, the most important thing is like that experience on set with all of your artists while you're making this thing, because it's not just what you're putting into it, it is what the collective is putting into it. And it's like whatever happens after that, it's a gift, but I don't think about that. That's not the reason to make something.
Was there like a particular turning point for you in switching that mindset and going from someone who looked for the reward after making a movie and instead started to value more the process of the making of? Was there a particular experience that kind of catalyzed that change?
I mean, all of our films were like complex in terms of like the making process and the reaction of our how our films are perceived. I mean, sometimes. Yeah, it's like I can like go through each experience. Like I think like Matrix is like it's a funny I mean it's an aberration for me and Lana because it's like our most successful You know, like, what is the barometer of success? It's like, this industry is like, it is so impossibly capitalist minded that it's like, we don't measure success by anything other than what the bottom line is. How much money did it make? You know, so there was, like, the Matrix came. I mean, there was something funny that happened early on for us, because like Bound came out and it got some mixed review, a lot of like mixed reviews, and a lot of like, you could tell there was a, what's the word I'm looking for? Ideological reviews that reflected a certain ideology. Like, we got a lot of bad reviews because people don't like queerness and lesbians and stuff like that. And the fact that the lesbians won in the end was like probably off-putting to a lot of people. So we got some good reviews, and we got, so, and then Bound came out, and it was, you know, it was not very successful in terms of box office. Successful from a critical point of view, you know, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel loved it a lot. So that was something that was cool, only because they were both from Chicago. But there was like this, the moment of seeing Bound in the Castro Theater with, you know, 900 lesbians or 900 queer folks. And the way that they responded to the film was this indelible way to define what success means for us. We might not have like understood it exactly, but that definitely made this impact. The way all those folks roared during that movie, the way that they got to the end and they couldn't believe that they were watching these two women drive off into the sunset. I was so staggered that I was able to like give them this gift, and I didn't quite understand it myself. And so then you move along and you look at like what Matrix did and the way it, like, people went to go see that film and these just droves, and the way that that box office success like opened the sandbox for us as filmmakers was, I don't know if it was like detrimental or if it was, if it set us up for an impossible bar to succeed. And then, you know, there was this, there was this just decline in terms of like, you know, what our films did at the box office. There was like, and it started critically the way that people responded to Reloaded and Revolutions. And like a lot of, you know, a lot of that criticism, I think, was around, there was like ideological criticism about that. Like, people don't want to, they don't want to engage with like socialist ideas, which was like a huge thing that we were working on, like from the idea of like Neo as this like rugged individual and the savior, and like tearing down, you know, the savior myth. I think like people subconsciously responded to that with a lot of vitriol. And then, you know, after that, it was like our films were just like, you know, we leaned more and more into socialist ideas, and they were like consistently rejected by audiences. And And I think like a lot of that came from, you know, politically they were too inaccessible to folks. Like, you know, we're to like a couple of trans women trying to work out our stuff. And like, you know, we are hardcore leftists, and you know, all of those themes are in the, in our films. And so like a show like Speed Racer, like after Speed Racer came along, and you know, it was like such a, we were on a plane, we had finished Speed Racer, it like went down to the wire, we went to the premiere, we got on a plane to go to Berlin, because James was getting ready to make Ninja Assassin with Chad Stahelski and Dave Leach as our stunt coordinators and like leaders of the second unit. And we were coming in there to shoot second unit with them. Speed Racer comes out and it's like a complete box office failure. People just like shit all over the movie. And then the first scene that we get to shoot is the scene with Rain and the Kingpin character in the bathroom. And it is like, that is where I started, it started to dawn on me, like the power and catharsis in making, because it was the bloodiest, goriest thing we had ever shot. And we got to the end of it and Rain is just pounding that, there's a prosthetic that Rain, it's like on a hinge, and Rain is like pounding this baddie's head into the urinal over and over. And there's no, the breakaway hasn't been put in there yet. And Rain is just wailing away on this like prosthetic guy's head. And it's just like pounding and pounding and pounding. And we let that shot go and go and go. And there was just like, yeah, it was, it opened new doors into what filmmaking could offer me as an artist. Like the making was like, that part was like, okay, I can see now that from henceforth, there's going to be a shift in the way that I bring my joy. And like that moment, it changed everything for us. We suddenly came out of the darkness after being able to shoot that. And so yeah, that was a long rambler.
I loved it.
But I think like, you know, it was like important to be able to answer that question.
No, totally.
That,
and I can imagine it's a much more sustainable way to make art, doing it for the intrinsic reason of the doing rather than, well, there's so much that's out of your control in terms of how people will respond to what you create and all those other things. But there is actually, speaking of that, Lily, like there is like a moment in your career, I suppose we should discuss, like there's an old adage among writers that when you put a story out into the world, it's no longer yours. Like it belongs to the audience and they're liable to interpret it in their own ways. You and Lana had to navigate one of the most extreme forms of that with the way the language and the iconography of the Matrix was kind of co-opted by communities who are polar opposite in terms of their worldview. These are communities who are pretty hateful in their ideologies. Can I ask how you navigated that? Like how you dealt with the fury that it must have prompted in you as someone who, you know, had poured her heart and soul into a film series, only for it to get kind of like ripped away from you. And well, people tried to rip it away from you and deploy that language and that iconography in ways that go against the entire message of your filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like something that I still grapple with. It's not, I don't have a pat answer to that. It's like, and it's like it's complicated because there I didn't feel like I could engage the world. It's like we didn't do interviews for a reason. It's like, you know, we didn't want anybody like probing into, not probing too much into the idea of what our films were about. And, you know, there's all sorts of like moments in my life where I can see how important context is. It's like, you know, you go to a museum and you look at a piece, and it, you know, if it's particularly some abstract piece, it's like often like if there is some card or something that like gives a description of the artist's life or, you know, what the piece is about, it becomes this key that unlocks things about the piece. But for me, like being closeted for so long, it was like I couldn't engage with folks when it comes to what our stuff is about. And so you know, like nowadays I struggle with you know, did I do a disservice not to, like, you know, tell people like Ivanka Trump and Elon Musk to, you know, fuck off earlier in my career. And it's like, even like you can see the, you know, Lana's engagement with those questions in, you know, her film Resurrections, you know, that is a response to, you know, the world and the way that they've like taken this thing and misinterpreted it. But, you know, that is what, like, I think, like, that's what propagandists and fascists have always done. They will always take work and try to mutate it and misinterpret it for their own means. And it's like, I have no... like I will not stop making films because I'm afraid that people are going to, you know, take it and misinterpret it. It's like, that is like, that is what being part of this collective is. It's like, we're all like singing to each other. We're all telling these stories and taking stories and like making them our own and then sending that signal out back out into the world. And like, you know, I think about like George Miller and what he did with the Road Warrior franchise. Like, you know, he made, you know, three films, and those films like were gobbled up and like reconstituted in so many different ways. To the point where he was able to like come back around and make that film and like go, hey, thanks for all that work, yoink, and took it back and like, you know, Borderlands, and like you can see how like Borderlands did all of this like previs for him, and he's like, oh yeah, thanks, I'll take that back now. Thanks for that. And like, you know, so here's me telling my story again and using it. And so, yeah, I just like, it makes me just zoom out. I'm always like trying to zoom out and zoom out further and seeing like larger and larger patterns and going, okay, this is okay. This is okay. You know, maybe tell people to fuck off a little bit more and you'll be okay.
Well, speaking of zooming out, it was 30 years ago this year that you and Lana began your journeys as working storytellers. That was when you first landed jobs writing comics for Marvel, and it was afterwards, of course, that you broke into film. That's a long time, and with it, you must have observed a lot of change. And I wanted to ask about the level of positive change that you've witnessed versus the negative, and how it feeds into something I wonder about often, which is rooted in a scene from the first Matrix. There's a sequence in that film in which Agent Smith has Morpheus chained to a chair, and he's telling him like the history of the Matrix, how the simulated world was designed to resemble the 90s, because that was the peak of human civilization, and it was all downhill from there. There are days when, from my admittedly pretty compromised viewpoint as a straight white guy, I'm personally of a mind that, you know, it's a more progressive film industry and a more progressive world that we live in today than existed 3 decades ago, and that's a good thing. Then there are more pessimistic days, I suppose, when I'm not really sure, when I look at the kind of extreme capitalism around us and the hero worship of these corrosive tech bros and the looming climate catastrophe and everything else. And yeah, I find myself wondering, was Smith onto something there? I wondered where you sat on that question and that scene, whether you're still able to be optimistic that we're heading in the right direction, that this is a survivable moment that we're in right now.
I mean, that scene with Agent Smith is interesting because, I mean, this is a white guy telling a chained black man that the 90s was the peak of civilization. And so, like, from a black perspective, you know, that the 90s were incredibly tumultuous. I mean, yeah, it's like there has been a lot of progress, but, you know, it's like it's just not, I think it's like good to like step outside and go, well, maybe from like a white guy's perspective, that's true, but always good to like zoom out from an idea like that. When I think about like what gives me, where do I find hope? You know, I don't know. It's like I'm constantly searching for it. It's I get a lot of like energy from young people. I feel like the way that young people are organizing against gun violence, are organizing against climate disaster, the way young people are organizing against poverty, are organizing for abolition. You know, I think we're at this specific point in time, the way that we're able to speak to one another and share ideas, that is the thing that to me is like unprecedented. It's like, you know, as a trans person, there weren't even the words to describe myself growing up. You know, we had, you know, transsexual and transvestite and, oh, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. You know, all of that stuff is so, it has such a cis normative lens that you're passing this information through that it doesn't even begin to describe like the depth and width of like gender. And so now we have, I thankfully live in a world where like, you know, even though there's like a ton of backlash and fascist resistance against the idea of who and what we are and can be, I think like that, you know, like going back to school and being around young people in the way that you would go around the room and talk about, you know, pronouns. And that was just like an impossible idea for me when I was a young person. I couldn't even imagine saying something like that. But it's now taken, found purchase, you know, it's found purchase in people's brains. And like, that is the thing that I think that I can hold on to and go, hang on, this might be okay if we can just keep pushing and expanding and connecting to one another and like sharing our points of view and be open to people's points of view. That is like what I wake up in the morning and try to find while I'm having my first cup of coffee.
Yeah. And I suppose film and art is such a great conduit for that sharing.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you mentioned there going back to school. And I'm aware that, you know, over the last few years, there has been as what you've described as a period of reconnection. And it's actually like a lesson that like I definitely learned from kind of following your career over the kind of last 5 years or so. I've come to realize I can't be the best storyteller I can be if I'm burned out and if I'm disconnected from myself. And it seems like you were at a similar place a couple of years ago. You had this opportunity to join Lana in making The Matrix Resurrections, but instead you made the decision to reconnect with yourself as an artist, as you put it, by going back to school, by painting, and yeah, just kind of having this kind of creative moment for yourself that wasn't in service of productivity. Can you talk to me about that spell? And because I mean, I think I read that you even tried a bit of stand-up comedy during that time, which sounds really fun. I'd love to hear a little bit about how re-energizing that was. And yeah, the importance of prioritizing your emotional self, your creative self as a writer amid kind of pressure from the hustle culture that we live in to kind of be constantly grinding away.
Yeah. So that started at the end of the first season of Sense8. We were going through a particularly grueling stretch where we went from Cloud Atlas to Jupiter Ascending to the first season of Sense8, where we would be posting and prepping at the same time. So we finished Cloud Atlas, which, you know, was an amazing, amazing experience to shoot. Amazing to be making this thing with that the filmmakers and the cast, and then to come out of the other side of that and like be in Berlin cutting the movie while simultaneously like figuring out how the boots worked and Jupiter Ascending, to the point where we ended up like building this enormous like skate park where it was just this half pipe, and we got these stuntmen, these people who were awesome on inline skates. And we put them on wires and they were flipping all around and going down this half pipe. And then, you know, okay, now we're shooting Jupiter Ascending. And oh yeah, by the way, now that you're in post on this, you have to start scouting and like flying all over the world and like go to Bombay. And okay, now you got to go to Mexico City and got to go to Iceland.
I'm exhausted just hearing about this.
Yeah, it was insane. So we got to that point, and you know, I'm like sticking my head out of the closet all the time, and my partner of 25 years is like, she's pretty convinced I'm like transitioning, and she's like, man, I don't want to be married to a woman. I'm like, okay, I guess I'll see you later. And you know, it was like, you know, like my world is falling apart in a way, but it's like I'm reconstructing it at the same time. We start shooting Sense8. I start hormones. I start medically transitioning, and I'm like the shell I've broken out of my egg, and I'm just like kind of sitting in it. My head is sticking out of the egg. And there's this moment during that shoot where I was like extremely keeping to myself, barricading myself in my room a lot. And there was this one time where I went out to dinner with the group of Sense8 actors, and Jamie Clayton comes over to me and she's like, "Okay, tell me what's going on. Tell me everything." And we have this little aside where I just tell her what's going on, and I'm like, I'm on hormones, and you know, I'm separated from my partner, but we're still like best friends, and you know, I'm crying every day when I take a plane flight because we've always traveled together, and I feel that that hole in my life. And she was just, the first thing that she said to me was like, "Congratulations," and how happy she was for me. And it like, it was so important and shocking to hear that, like this thing where I felt so, I had so much fear, like the idea about coming out of the closet. Anyway, so I got to the end of that and I was like, okay, so I know that if I'm going to ride this TV schedule, that I have to, you know, I have to transition, and I better do it fast. And so I was like, okay, I had to come out. We got to post-production, and I was kind of in this habit trail of like the office and my house. And I would go to the office, and you know, I came out to everybody in the office, and everybody was great. And like in these increasingly bigger circles, but always contained. And I got to the end. It was like almost like I was beta testing my gender, and I came out of that, and I was so ground down by the process that I was just like, I wasn't sure if I was going to come back. I had set myself up to be able to like, okay, I have now this summer before writing starts again, probably. And I was having a hard time as an artist. I was having a hard time in all of my relationships. I think they all like suffered under that period of time, not just my Elisa, who was my partner. And I was longing for a connection beyond like my work family. And so at some point I made a decision to just like walk away, and my mom. And so I was able to like reconnect with my mom and dad. My mom had borderline dementia, and I was able to like, this period of time was like this super gift where I was able to like, you know, I started taking I would help my dad with my mom, and he was like, "Oh, why don't you all go paint together?" And so I started taking my mom's painting class, and then that was getting too much. So we ended up like, she finished like her payment period, and then we were just like, I just started taking her to her studio, and we started painting together. It was this great way to reconnect to my mom for this period. And then, you know, I started dating this trans guy, and he was a professor down at SAIC, and he was encouraging me to come and go back to school. And so I did that for a while, and I was able to like, I started to be able to reconnect to myself as an artist. And like, when you paint, it's like you just make a painting, and it's like, you can't, do I make a painting so that it's going to be at a museum? No, it's like you paint to paint the painting. And I was like, that was another way for me to like go, oh, this is about the making. I am satisfying some part of myself as an artist with this painting. I get to like, look at this painting all the time. That's like, that's me, that duck in the center of all of that turmoil and blood and fire tornadoes is me. That's how I am in the world. That's who I am. And I am like creating the light that I want to be in the world. Yeah, I don't. I think I was like going off the tracks a little bit, but yeah.
So that really brought, it sounds like that really painting, it sounds like was a big part in finding your way back to, well, not just to yourself, but a new version of yourself.
Yes, for sure. For sure. You know, it's like, it's this thing that connects me to myself. It connects me to my mom. You know, that was like my mom, like, my mom and dad like made us get, they are why I'm an artist. They like showed us the beauty of films. My mom gave me the ability to look at the world in wonder. And like, she made us take art classes. She made us like perform in plays. Mom and dad like encouraged all of that in us. And, you know, when I paint, I connect to my mom. When I paint, I can connect to my aunt who also likes to paint. And it's just, that's, yeah, that's why I do it.
And where has that led you in terms of who you are now as a storyteller, Lily? You've mentioned a few times over this conversation, projects you're working on at the moment. It's an amazing 3 decades of work that you have already to your name. Like when you look forward into the next chapter of your career, the types of stories you'd still like to tell, what do you see? And yeah, where would you like to explore that perhaps has not yet been explored?
Okay. So like, I cannot emphasize enough how, what a profound experience working on work in progress was for me, that surrounding myself with queer artists and trans artists and, you know, people of color, Black and brown folks, and, you know, non-binary folks, like just the simple act of like giving people jobs. That, like, I mean, I didn't understand, I've never like experienced that to that effect, you know? And so that's like one of the main reasons I'm sticking around in this industry, because I see how important it is to center marginalized voices. And it's like, you know, I'm getting to be a certain age where it's like, it's as a filmmaker, I have to be able to step aside. It's like, it's time for new people to come on and like tell us stories. And whatever I can do to facilitate that process with Black and brown folks and with trans folks and queer folks, that's what I want to do. That's why that was like, that like gets my motor running, like big, even just speaking about it, I'm like excited to do that. Cause the monoculture that like Hollywood is like gravitating towards is the death of all of those voices. And it's like, I'm going to like throw my body, my trans body, against that as much as I possibly can.
I think I know what you mean when you describe the monoculture, but can I just invite you to expand on that a bit more, Lily? What it is you're describing when you use that phrase?
I mean, I can't, like, I don't want to, like, cast a huge paintbrush against art, because I know, like, I, you know, as a kid, you know, we would go to see as many types of movies as we possibly could. And they were like, a lot of them were, you know, goofy, and a lot of them were, you know, thrown together and a mishmash of stuff. But because filmmaking is like this collaborative process, it's like there are so many different aspects to a film that you can turn it over and say, oh my God, this is wonderful what this actor is doing. Or look at the way that DP lit that shot. It's like, oh, it's evocative of this. You can really see that they're putting a lot of joy into it. And so, like, I don't want to discredit than all of the artists who work on like this like product, right? When I talk about monoculture, really what I'm talking about is like, you know, an accountant's pen that is like, you can feel the pen strokes in behind the scenes of the piece, where it's like, the reason to make it is to turn a profit. And it's the profiteering aspect of monoculture that I see as like the real poison in the industry, because it informs every single decision to this thing that is like a thing that some salesperson is trying to, you know, sell to you. So yeah, that's what I mean by that.
Would you, if you were able to infiltrate that space, that blockbuster space again, doing so with a team of queer filmmakers, filmmakers of color, would that be a canvas size that you'd like to work on again? Do you have aspirations still to kind of like make big blockbuster spectacles? Or was the process of making Work in Progress, which was a bit of a departure for you, was that just so fulfilling that you'd love to concentrate on doing more things like that, that are as important stories, if not more important stories, but just smaller, I suppose, in sci-fi scale compared to some of your previous work?
I don't think I'm like limiting my aspirations. If I was pitching a version of this super wonderful comic book called Cosmonites around town. It's, you know, super queer. It's just anybody who like has a chance to go buy this comic book, go buy it, because it's like, it's so wonderful and so queer. There's space lesbians, and it's just the artist, Hannah Templer, is writing and drawing exactly what they want to see. And there's so much joy in it. So like, that was the thing that we, that I was on board with a bunch of other super cool people, Emily Andrus and, oh my God, her name just went out of my head. Oh God, I'm so sorry. Paper Kite, she was in, the television show, the Parks and Rec.
Oh, Amy Poehler?
Yes, Amy Poehler.
Yeah, wow.
She was going to produce it. She was producing. And, you know, we pitched it all over, and it was, you know, the way the industry is just like, you know, it's too queer. It's too trans. It's too. So, I mean, we didn't hear that explicitly from people, but, and it's still, we're still pushing to try and get it made, but, you know, it's a thing that is like, you know, was in that level of filmmaking, you know, and like world building. I think that like the scale of Work in Progress is the palette, the canvas size is a little more is a little more manageable in terms of like folks willing to like, yeah, get on board. I mean, it's like, even still, it's not I'm still like having trouble like finding financial partners for queer stuff. And that's just the way the industry is. It's just like, yeah.
Amidst that, what is your advice to writers who, you know, who've been so moved by your fight back against like the limitations imposed on queer storytellers and any marginal group? What is your advice for writers who want to join that fight, who are picking up their pens today and want to kind of emulate some of the change that you've enacted on the industry, Lily?
You know, like the idea that you cannot make art in a vacuum. It's like we are, our voice is a voice of a multitude of folks and artists and relationships that have come before us, right? It's like when I sit down and I try to write something, it's not just me that's writing it. It's all of these like influences that I have. And so like the thing that I think about for, or the advice that I give to myself, that I always have to give to myself, is to lean into that connectivity. We have to be able to stick our head outside of that vacuum as much as we can and find community. We need to find, we need to like find connectivity. It's like, I mean, it is a microcosm to like a larger scale. Like the only way that we are going to survive is in our connectivity. The only way that our ball in space is going to survive is by connecting to one another, connecting to our humanity. And so like, I would say that if you like now zoom in to that page, that artist is, that writer is like struggling against, I would make sure that what they would do is like, you know, reach out and try to find community as much as possible, because that's going to like, it's going to open up what that page can be ultimately.
That is so beautiful and such a beautiful place to leave this conversation, Lily. I've just realized we've been talking for 2 hours. It's flown by. I thought it was like 45 minutes or something. I can't tell you how fueled I feel by this conversation. It's just been such a delight.
Thanks so much, Al. I hope I was good. I hope I was okay.
You were fantastic. Yeah, no, I can't thank you enough for doing this. And I'm sure all our listeners share that sentiment. So thank you so much for coming on Script Apart, this storyteller session. And we really do appreciate it, Lily.
My pleasure. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.